bigger agenda, which is to make this country a white Christian nation, to strip people of their citizenship. They're going to go after certain kinds of people. Obviously, we see in the mass deportation system, we see in their end to the amnesty programs and refugee programs, and we see in this the attempt to eliminate the diversity, which actually has to be done by Congress. But, you know, they do all these things because they don't like the color or the politics of the people who come to this country.
Last quick question. A federal judge this week ruled the Trump administration broke the law by limiting Congress members' access to ICE jails. Can you talk about the significance of this? We have 20 seconds.
Well, the Trump administration acts with no oversight whatsoever, whether it's the Supreme Court or Congress. He is acting like a dictator, an authoritarian, and it's just a terrible thing. And the American people have to protest and oppose these.
Mei Nai, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor of Asian American Studies and History at Columbia University, author of several books, including the award-winning Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign now through December 31st.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction in partnership with Business Oregon, working to support those caring for children of journey workers in Oregon, even family and friends. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, new data shows a slight drop in those who died while homeless in Multnomah County last year.
The Oregon Farmworkers Union holds immigration advocacy strikes in several cities.
And in national news, the social media app TikTok will be sold to a Trump ally.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 19th, 2025. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we would like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Anna Wilcox.
And I'm Sam Bowman. 372 homeless Multnomah County residents died in 2024, according to the just-released Domicile Unknown report. The name refers to how medical examiner reports denote that a person has no fixed address. Each December, the report compiles demographic data about people who died the year before. This year's report shows an 18% decrease in deaths compared to 2023. It's the first decrease in deaths the county has reported since they started collecting the data in 2011. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson spoke at a press conference earlier today.
The fact remains that far too many people are dying while experiencing homelessness, reflecting the harsh conditions those living on the streets face every single day. Fentanyl in particular continues to devastate our community. While unacceptably high, the 18% decrease in deaths from 2023 to 2024 provides some hope that our investments to grow a continuum of homelessness and behavioral health services are making a difference and saving lives.
A majority of the deaths of unhoused residents came from accidental causes like drug overdoses. The average age of homeless Multnomah County residents was 48. That's 30 years younger than the average life expectancy in the U.S. Homeless county residents were 6 times more likely to die than housed residents. Homeless men were much more likely to die than homeless women, and homeless residents who were Black or Native were overrepresented in the death statistics. Traffic crashes were the second leading cause of death for unhoused county residents. The study found homeless residents were 23 times more likely to be killed in traffic than other residents. Paul Soucy is the vendor program director at Street Roots. He said it's good to get the data, but there are real limitations to consider.
I want to underscore here that this important work captures specific data, and it's critical to have that information as we collectively make decisions for the health and safety of our larger communities. But this data masks the real stories and identities of the people that they represent. And this data exists in a really specific moment in time that doesn't keep up with current circumstances. Since I joined Street Roots as vendor program director in July of this year, I have witnessed 6 deaths in our community of vendors. Some were folks living in supportive housing or hospice programs. Some were living in the tents and sleeping bags that are so conspicuously intolerable to so many members of our community. Just yesterday, we hosted a memorial service at Street Roots for 2 trans individuals who passed from overdose. A third member of that small family survived the same substances and came to us to hold a memorial space for them, since no one else in the community would do so. I mention these small, localized anecdotes because homelessness is not tents, it's not garbage, it's not needles on the ground or sleeping bags in your doorways. These are human beings. We are human beings with dignity, love, histories, communal and familial ties amongst all of us. You can't simply warehouse people against their will and withhold tents and sleeping bags and thereby assume that the problem is going away. We are your family members, your students, your neighbors, your elders. We share your faiths and your dreams, your disciplines and your accomplishments. If this data indicates anything, it's that our community's significant investments over the last several years are now beginning to make a difference in the lethality of living on the streets of Portland.
That was Paul Soucy, the vendor program director at Street Roots. The most recent data on homelessness in the county from October showed 17,000 homeless residents, with some 7,800 living unsheltered. The annual Homeless Day of Remembrance Memorial Service will be held on Sunday, the 21st, at St. Andre Bessette Catholic Church at Northwest 6th Avenue in Burnside at 5 p.m.
On Thursday, Oregon's Farm Workers Union, BAKUN, held strikes for a day without an immigrant in several cities. BAKUN and its precursor organization, the Willamette Valley Immigration Project, have advocated for immigration reform and protections for undocumented workers since 1977. KABU visited the picket line in Woodburn, where BAKUN is headquartered. We talked with BAKUN President Reyna Lopez about what a day without an immigrant is really about.
My voice is a little raspy because we're yelling at the top of our lungs today. So hopefully the president, ICE, every Oregon elected official, every business owner in Oregon finally hears us. Our communities have experienced a reign of terror from ICE. Every single day, just here in our community, our dads, our moms, our friends, our family, our brothers, our sisters, they're driving to work at the crack of dawn in the morning, and we don't know if they're going to come back. It all really started on October 30th when 35 workers were going to work in the morning. Farm workers, construction workers, landscapers, and they did not come home that day because ICE was patrolling our community. They targeted a van that was full of workers, multiple vans full of workers, and they took them. And ever since then, our community has been literally so tense, scared, and also very upset. As you can tell today, businesses downtown are closed, and several lines have been crossed. Citizens have been arrested by ICE. Children have had guns pointed at them by ICE. And, you know, if that's not enough for people to have, like, their red lines crossed, then please tell me that a secret police force that only answers to Trump is scaring you, that covers their face. So today, a day without an immigrant is really to show our power, you know, and to go from this place of being scared to saying, hey, we're powerful here too. We are the workers that are the backbone of a lot of Oregon's most important sectors and a lot of America's most important sectors. We think that it's time that people recognize that, even people who are against our community, to be acknowledging that they don't eat without farm workers. They don't have houses without construction workers. They don't have a country without Mexicans and immigrants that come from all over the world and make this country great. So, you know, I think that one of the biggest reasons that it's important to be out here and say, hey, you guys need something from us. If you don't care about anything else, you all want our labor, you want our time, you want our money, and we're gonna flex that today. That's why we're asking people to start practicing boycotting and taking the day off work, not buying anything, not shopping online, nothing, because we are one of the biggest economies in the world, just Latinos that live in the United States. And we're not even talking about the rest of the immigrant population. So what a day without an immigrant is today, why we're doing this, there's a few goals that we have. Number one is the very immediate goal of just getting ICE out of our community. We don't want them here. We don't want them terrorizing our family. They're not welcome in Woodburn. And the second thing is to really get other sectors to get excited too. You know, we're workers and we represent a voice, right? But there's businesses here, you know, Safeway's here, Sherwin-Williams, Viva, you know, Dutch Bros, all of these folks, we need them to be with us. I know we're not always in agreement, but this is a day that we can agree, like, these are important people in our community. And the third thing is we want to change this conversation. We don't want to talk about ICE anymore. We want to talk about a pathway to legalization, a pathway to citizenship. Because at the end of the day, all of this could be avoided with a stroke of a pen. So those are our demands today, but they will continue to expand as we go into the Oregon legislature.
During the strike, dozens gathered in a popular business district near a Safeway grocery store. Demonstrators chanted from the sidewalk alongside Highway 99E. Some strikers held red signs saying, "Stand with immigrants." Others waved homemade posters criticizing ICE and the Trump administration. Lopez told KBOO what makes Woodburn such a special place.
Oregon, you're snoozing on Woodburn. This is one of the most vibrant agricultural districts in the entire state. This is the hub of where Christmas trees get shipped all over the world. We're the number one. This is also the home of Pecun, Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste. We're one of the oldest farm worker organizations here in Oregon, led by Latinos, led by immigrants, started and founded by farm workers who were immigrants, mostly from Mexico. And this is also one of the first Latino municipalities in the entire state. We have vibrant Latino businesses downtown that literally, like, that is the heart of our downtown. It's nicknamed Little Mexico because of all the awesome shops that are down there where a lot of our community goes to get things that they wouldn't get anywhere else. So this is a very special place. Don't sleep on Woodburn. This is one of the best places to be, best places to work, and this community really cares and really cares about what happens in Oregon.
Megun will host the next Day Without an Immigrant in January.
Oregon immigration attorneys and community members testified in federal court on Thursday about Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE's, policy of denying detained people access to a lawyer. It was an evidentiary hearing in the class action case Clear Clinic v. Nome. Attorneys testified about the problems they've had trying to reach clients. Josephine Moberg from Clear Clinic told the court that ICE would only allow her to visit clients through plexiglass, without a phone, only speaking through small holes in the glass. Another immigration attorney in Eugene hasn't been allowed past the lobby of the ICE office there since September, and she's been threatened with a trespassing charge for trying to access her client. Others detailed ICE abductions and transfers that happened so quickly that people were brought to the Tacoma ICE Detention Center without ever getting counsel. The plaintiffs say it's important to ensure that Oregonians have meaningful access to an attorney before they are transferred out of state. They say loved ones and lawyers can sometimes wait for days to locate their family member or talk with them. Over 1,000 Oregonians have been detained by ICE this year, more than half of them since September. The Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees anyone accused of a crime the right to representation.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be overcast with a chance of rain and snow mix. The overnight low will be 40 degrees. A flood watch is in place for northwest Oregon and southwest Washington until tomorrow morning. And tomorrow, it will be rainy with a high of 48. Today in history, in 1983, the original FIFA World Cup trophy, the Jules Rimet Trophy, is stolen from the headquarters of the Brazilian Football Confederation in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The quote of the day is from American protest singer Phil Oakes, who said, quote, "It is wrong to expect a reward for your struggles. The reward is the act of struggle itself, not what you win. Even though you can't expect to defeat the absurdity of the world, you must make that attempt. That's morality. That's religion. That's art. That's life."
TikTok has signed a deal to sell its U.S. operations to a group controlled by Oracle. Oracle is a technology company that sells database software, enterprise applications, and cloud infrastructure that was founded by Larry Ellison, Bob Miner, and Ed Oates in 1977. Ellison has a close relationship with Donald Trump and is called a, quote, shadow president in Trump's America. TikTok's algorithm has collected a massive amount of data from millions of Americans that will be overseen by the new U.S. firm. Under the terms of sale, half of the new entity that will control the American version of TikTok will be owned by a group of investors including Oracle, private equity firm Silver Lake, and United Arab Emirates state-backed investment firm MGX. The underlying algorithm will still be owned by Beijing-based ByteDance, who will retain a third of the investors. The deals cap more than 5 years of pressure from the U.S. about TikTok's ties to China and concerns about propaganda and use of U.S. data. In 2024, Congress passed a law that would have banned the app unless it was sold. The Supreme Court upheld that law in January. For months, TikTok was technically operating in violation of federal law, but Trump issued multiple executive actions to delay enforcement of the law. Technically, since ByteDance still has ties to TikTok, it is still in violation. TikTok has an estimated 2 billion daily users globally, less than 10% live in the U.S. A new U.S. entity overseeing the American version of the app creates an interesting situation. One version of the app is controlled and monitored by the U.S., while ByteDance retains full control of the app globally. The deal is a big one for Larry Ellison and Oracle, expanding their control on the American entertainment and technology industries. Larry's son, David Ellison, recently bought CBS News and its parent company, Paramount.
After a House vote failed to extend the ACA tax credits, healthcare groups across the country are assessing potential impacts on coverage, costs, and access to care. Crystal Blair has more in Michigan.
In a vote this week, the U.S. House of Representatives approved a health care bill that did not extend Enhanced Affordable Care Act tax credits. Those subsidies would have helped hundreds of thousands of Michiganders afford coverage through the ACA marketplace. Without further action from Congress, the credits are set to expire at the end of this year. Vaisha Jawahar with the health policy group Protect Our Care says coverage losses don't stop people from needing care. She says instead, they can shift cost throughout the healthcare system.
They'll have to go to the ER, and they'll probably end up in the ER in worse condition and need more expensive treatment. And a lot of those times, those costs, what we call the cost of uncompensated care, will get passed on to others through higher bills at the hospital and also higher premiums.
House Republican leaders say the healthcare bill they passed would lower insurance premiums for all Americans and includes other reforms. Some point to alternative measures, such as changes to cost-sharing reductions and support for health savings accounts or association plans as part of their long-term strategy. But beyond premiums and policy debates, Michigan health providers say federal funding decisions can also affect whether people struggling with addiction are able to stay connected to treatment and recovery services. Kate Hootie, executive director of the Michigan Association of Treatment Court Professionals, says many people served by treatment courts depend on Medicaid.
Any threats to Medicaid really put our participants in their recovery journey at risk of no longer being able to receive those life-sustaining services.
Lawmakers say moderate House Republicans and Senate counterparts are exploring a bipartisan compromise, aiming to act before the January 30th funding deadline. For the Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
Legal fights over free speech, federal power, and public accountability take center stage as courts, campuses, and communities confront the reach of government authority. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This case is about yet another public university punishing a professor for the views that they express.
Ghadir Abbas with the Council on American Islamic Relations is arguing in a federal court on behalf of a University of Kentucky law professor who says he was suspended and barred from campus after criticizing Israel, which CARE calls a clear violation of academic free speech. Abbas says courts across the country have consistently upheld First Amendment protections, regardless of ideology. After last weekend's killing of two at Brown University, police say there might be a connection with the shooting 50 miles away. An MIT physics professor died after being wounded in his home. No suspect has been publicly identified in either case. A Chicago teachers union says it's stepping in to support families rattled by immigration raids. Union Vice President Jackson Potter says this started organically at the grassroots.
People coming out of the woodwork, setting up rapid response, going to schools before and after dismissal to protect and defend.
The Trump administration wants to halt gender-related care for minors, threatening to cut off hospital funding and Medicaid payments. Families seeking the treatments call that government overreach. But Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says they're drawing a hard line against a false idea that could permanently harm young people.
The first rule of our hospitals that participate in Medicare and Medicaid, which is almost every hospital, from performing these dangerous and harmful procedures.
The major medical organizations say gender care saves lives and is almost always easily reversible. A board handpicked by President Donald Trump has voted unanimously to rename Washington's Kennedy Center as the Trump Kennedy Center. The change may require congressional approval. The president is also signing an executive order moving marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, expanding research access and easing tax rules while stopping short of legalization. Under criticism for his economic policies, Trump says the government will pay a one-time warrior dividend of $1,776 to service members. He says the payments funded in part by tariffs reflect a stronger economy. Many of the Biden-era projects aiming to shift Appalachia from coal to clean energy have had their funding revoked by the Trump White House. Dana Kunlein at Reimagine Appalachia says their research shows that stalling clean energy investments in the Inflation Reduction Act is putting tens of thousands of jobs at risk.
We saw a huge spike in clean energy and manufacturing investments. And with the changes we've seen from the Trump administration throughout 2025, those big spikes have turned into a flat line and even a downturn.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
North Carolina's Lumbee Tribe is finally federally recognized. They are the 575th tribe to receive federal recognition. That status brings with it a number of benefits for tribal members. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's official. With the swipe of President Donald Trump's pen, North Carolina's Lumbee Tribe is now the 575th federally recognized tribe in the U.S. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Dozens of members of the Lumbee Tribe traveled from North Carolina to Washington to be a part of history this week. Tears were heard in the gallery after the U.S. Senate approved the measure granting the Lumbee federal recognition on Wednesday. And after President Donald Trump signed it into law Thursday, Lumbee Chairman John Lowry could barely contain his joy.
Joy cometh in the morning, and our joy is here. It's here. We finally achieved what our ancestors fought so long and so hard to achieve.
There are roughly 60,000 members of the Lumbee, making it the largest Native American tribe east of the Mississippi River. North Carolina officials recognized the tribe after the Civil War in 1885. But not federal officials. North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis has helped lead the fight in the Senate in recent years.
Yeah, we're a little bit excited. After 137 years for on their part, about 4 years on Senate members' part, it's good to see it get done.
Tillis is retiring at the end of his term next year, but he says the decade-long battle for federal recognition for the Lumbee shows Washington isn't totally broken. Even if the tribe and North Carolina lawmakers fought an uphill battle for years now.
A lot of educating and just prioritize. It's the way this country works, right? You use leverage, you have discussions, you build a case. I think that's what happened. I really appreciate the delegation. This was a well-coordinated effort.
Back in 1956, Congress partially recognized the Lumbee, but that left the tribe locked out of federal health services. And it meant the tribe couldn't operate casinos or marijuana dispensaries like other tribes. Chairman Lowry says it's a new day for the Lumbee.
The 1956 Act, which left us in legal limbo, is now erased. It is no more. And we are now fully, fairly recognized.
The Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians fought the federal recognition of the Lumbee, which passed as a part of an annual $900 billion defense authorization bill. For National Native News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
This week, the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation in Kansas issued a statement to its tribal members about an ICE contract after the deal was met with public scrutiny. In a video statement, Chairman Joseph Rupnik said the nation has fully divested from the contract.
As a result, Prairie Band LLC is no longer a direct or indirect donor or participant in or otherwise affiliated with any ICE projects, contracts, or operations. In our next General Council meeting in January, Tribal Council plans to further address the steps we will take to ensure that our nation's economic interests do not come into conflict with our values in the future.
Tribal citizens from across the U.S. have raised concerns about the Trump administration's immigration policies. Native people have also reported being confronted by ICE, including actress Elaine Miles sharing her story with media outlets about her encounter in November. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Brian Schatz, vice chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, U.S. Senator Patty Murray, vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and 10 of their Senate colleagues recently sent a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem about reports of ICE encounters with tribal citizens. They're urging her to develop policies and trainings to recognize tribal IDs. They're requesting a response by January 11th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Environmental and tribal advocates throughout the Midwest are renewing calls to shut down Enbridge's aging Line 5 pipeline, citing spill risks, repeated leaks, and violations of state and tribal sovereignty laws, while arguing that viable energy alternatives already exist. They say decommissioning the pipeline would protect the Great Lakes, uphold critical laws, and have little to no negative impact on regional energy supplies, despite industry claims about jobs and energy needs. Judith Ruiz Branch has the details.
The standoff over the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline continues as Midwest advocates fight to protect the Great Lakes from potential spill risks and the laws they say the pipeline's been violating for over a decade. Originating near the Illinois and Wisconsin border, the Canadian oil company's aging pipeline runs through the Straits of Mackinac. It delivers about 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas each day. Beth Wallace with the National Wildlife Federation says environmental advocates have been calling for its shutdown for years. She stresses the ongoing debate over protecting water or securing energy is ill-advised.
We have known that there are alternatives to Line 5 for over 5 years now. So a decommissioning of Line 5 could mean an increase in jobs or an increase in utilizing other transportation sources to get products to market.
She suggests another alternative is using existing pipelines that Enbridge operates that already have capacity. A recent report outlines a range of options to affected markets in the event of a Line 5 shutdown. Wallace says they're calling on lawmakers to consider these alternatives as they would have no noticeable impacts and would boost U.S. energy supplies while upholding critical laws. Just this week, a federal judge blocked an attempt by Michigan's governor to shut down the pipeline, finding that only the federal government can regulate interstate pipeline safety. The Trump administration has argued in filings that the attempt interferes with U.S. foreign energy policy. Line 5 also runs through a Native American reservation in Wisconsin, which tribal leaders say violates state and tribal sovereignty laws. Wallace emphasizes what a dangerous precedent Line 5 has set for national battles over water policy, indigenous rights, and the role of fossil fuels, as she says it grants permission to corporations like Enbridge to violate critical laws.
What Line 5 is showing us is that our systems are so broken that we can have a foreign oil corporation challenging both tribal and state sovereignty rights in Great Lakes laws for almost a decade and continue to make $1 to $2 million of profit every single day just through legal challenges.
According to the Pipeline and Hazardous